I was going to ask how you would describe that dispute. How would you characterize it?
I don't know whether I would call it a dispute. It was simply the circumstances of the coordination to make them good neighbors hadn't been pre-planned.
When I referred to the land claim dispute, this was a legal issue of great concern to the planning department of Burnaby and eventually to the university when it became clear that they were expected to get into real estate promotion, just like McGill or University of Toronto or any number
UBC.
Once the university got the message that they had to involve themselves in real estate development, then the land claim dispute emerged. But it didn't affect communities as such. This was a high-level thing. And the other lucky piece of this puzzle is that Aboriginal claims on Burnaby Mountain were, and for that matter still are, quite murky.
I didn't realize there were any.
Well, everything is under claim,
okay. Yeah.
But there were no federally registered Indian lands on the south side of the inlet. The federally registered lands are on the other side of the inlet. So again, that's kind of an accident of history.
And one of the points also is that the university was established as a provincial institution and the land was somehow made available. The municipality had to agree, or did agree to that. But the university didn't directly have responsibility to the municipality for its operations.
Right.
It came to operate as an employment center and as a cultural center, and in lots of ways it was part of the city's development, but the city had no way of coping with that, over which they didn't have jurisdiction in its founding.
Right,
it was a provincial matter in the municipal context.
Right, which was... It's interesting that that ambiguity should be part of the original agreement, that in fact there was this little kind of dance between the municipality and SFU for almost three decades.
That's exactly true.
And it did stem from the municipality believing that its zoning did supersede development by SFU.
Exactly.
So it didn't want to see market housing within the Ring Road, and it didn't want to see development outside the Ring Road, unless the city was involved. Right?
My impression was that that wasn't resolved till the more or less the election in the middle 1990s, 1996 was it? Where the NDP promised they would find a certain amount of parkland in the province and a certain amount in the Lower Mainland. And where do you find that? Well, what they did was, it was the boundary zone between the university lands and the municipal parklands, and the university agreed to shrink its allocation of land, which the balance of that land went back to the municipality on the grounds that the university could develop the lands that remained. And it was at that point that the university concept came.
Yeah, it was the election of 1991 that was pivotal.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Mike Harcourt was elected on this plank.
That's right.
Of reserving X percentage of the province's parks. Meanwhile, the Burnaby Citizens Association, which is the NDP farm team in Burnaby, saw the election of Harcourt as the opportunity to resolve the dispute. And Harcourt found $1 million to, I won't use the term bribe, as an incentive to the parties to settle.
It's interesting that both
know about the money side of it.
Oh yeah, $1 million.
Yes.
Well, the member, one of the oddities, again, truth is stranger than fiction. The member of the legislature who was elected in 1991 was a resident of Burnaby Mountain. To this day, he is the last remaining resident of the older housing stock, such as it was, on Burnaby Mountain.
Oh.
His name is Barry Jones.
Oh.
And you have to talk to Barry Jones if you want to get us.
Well, he is, in fact, on my list.
Yes. Yes.
And I didn't realize he lived on the mountain.
Yes.
But if
you drive to the park, it's called, I think, Centennial Park, something like that.
Yes, yep, where the pavilion area is.
On the left-hand side, as you're driving up, you'll see a house when the leaves are down, and that's Barry Jones's house.
Oh, is it? Okay, that's interesting.
And we in the NDP used to sit around his backyard and survey the terrain, and he would talk about, you know, his empire building.
So the story of Burnaby Mountain is in part a political story, too. Then.
Oh, it's very political.
Yes, certainly the resolution.
Not just the history of the mountain. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that both of you have described it as legal murkiness that needed to be clarified. Because there does seem to have been values involved in here. The Burnaby people are really quite attached to the mountain. In 1974, the city had public hearings for town with regard to town planning in Grove. Do you remember that at all in 1974?
I myself don't. But
okay.
Go ahead.
And at the people that spoke at these public hearings really desired to have parkland set aside on the mountain. And they wanted to have the traditional landmark character of the mountain preserved.
Mm-hmm.
And as well, in 1988, when things started to really heat up between the city and SFU, there was a group of citizens that were concerned about preserving that parkland. Did you know about the Burnaby Mountain Preservation
mm-hmm.
Society?
Oh, yes.
Tell me what you know about them.
They were one of a plethora of organizations who were part of the sort of second wave environmental movement. We used to call them wilderness romantics. But in fact, looking back in a more measured way, one can see them as pioneers of the notion of a holistic urban plan. You know, honestly, the working class folks inside the NDP thought these, you know, what's the wilderness, Burnaby Mountain? But looking back, I can see their point. And their interest dovetailed with many other groups. I'll give you a concrete example. One of Barry's political issues was the increased flow of traffic on Curtis Parker. Back in 1967, it wasn't an issue, mm-hmm. but by 1987, this was a
was.
Big
yeah.
issue.
Mm-hmm.
And every voter who lived on that stretch, you know, from Burnaby Mountain to Burnaby to
yeah.
Boundary Road, was agitating for traffic calming. Again, this was connected with the urban environmentalist movement. What Barry's solution consisted of was getting back to some earlier plans for transportation up the mountain and closing off the Curtis-Duthie route up the hill. That dovetailed with the urban environmentalists. It also dovetailed with the voters, and finally with TransLink, because TransLink had a, or whatever it was called at the time, BC Transit, they had a maintenance problem with the buses that would grind
up. It was a very steep access.
It was a very steep hill. And so I remember Barry organized some public meetings, and different factions were there talking about their ideas about roads. And it was clear to me that he was not just buffeted around by public opinion. He had an idea. The planners in Burnaby had an idea to put a cul-de-sac at the top of Curtis Duffy and invest in that new road, which has a much better grade to it. And when that road was built in the early 1990s...
That's the one that comes up from Hastings.
Right. Yeah,
that's so. The only time that there were evictions. There were people evicted when that Burnaby Mountain Parkway went through.
Do you know who those would have been?
Maybe two or three families who lived in ramshackle homes, mm-hmm. clinging to the side of the mountain.
Mm-hmm. Now, why would the environmental movement be keen about the parkway?
Well, because it was an access for recreational tourism.
Which is what they were advocating as for the park?
Yeah, because, I mean, honestly, to call them wilderness romantics, that was just a sectarian comment that we bandied about. They wanted hiking trails. They wanted people to go up there on the bus. Okay,
the
road was fine from the environmental standpoint. The road was fine so long as it was well-serviced by BC Transit or TransLink, which it is. The 135 bus goes up there. The 144.
It also connects with Gullardy Way and provides another access route in the metropolitan commuting system. And people come from the Lougheed area and go across the mountain to the Hastings area without having to go all the way around to Willingdon or someplace like that.
So there were no objections then from the environmentalists for the parkway, because I'm thinking about all the deer that were eventually killed on the parkway.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't a concern.
Was that a significant problem?
Well, it was in the newspaper that it did increase the deer kill.
Yeah, the true wilderness romantics, honestly, of course, they didn't want more people going up the mountain. But the more pragmatic people who were interested in urban recreation were satisfied.
And keeping in mind, the university was already there by this time.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm just going to go back to the beginning. I had some questions about that this is the 50th anniversary of the university. And I know the academic and institutional history of the university has been well covered by Hugh Johnson's book, Radical Campus. I'm sorry, I missed his lecture. Was it quite good?
Yeah, I missed it as well.
Oh,
it was a terrible night.
It was
I couldn't get out.
Night.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, of course, the wonderful oral histories that were created by the SFU Retirees mm-hmm. Association. So this interview is about SFU's history from the perspective of its place on Burnaby Mountain. So when SFU is looked at as part of the mountain's history, what kinds of issues and topics come to the foreground? Because we're not talking about the institutional academic history anymore. So what would be the issues and topics if we're looking at the history of Burnaby Mountain?
Well, student housing is a long-standing...
That's an issue. Always has been an issue.
Yes.
Because inadequate housing was provided on top of the mountain for many years. They did try in the middle 70s when Pauline Jewett was the president to build some more. But it was always difficult to get funds for that. And at the same time, we were comparing ourselves with other universities who are on a different cycle. UVic, for example, at that same time built a lot of student housing. And they did that deliberately to attract students from the interior. So that kept their enrollments up. And both universities have a momentum of enrollment growth, which kind of chugs along at a sort of approximately the same rate, but on a slightly different cycle. And housing was one of the issues that fed into that. So as part of that, you're also talking about access to the university for students. And so there's the question of the bus access and eventually the SkyTrain stop at the bottom of the hill. Commuting students by car and parking places on top of the mountain, all interrelated to the issue.
Yeah, the
housing.
Urban geography here never lent itself to the establishment of a student ghetto, like a downtown school, like Toronto or Hamilton or whatever.
No.
The student ghetto, such as it is dispersed in a not obviously around the mountain, but a horseshoe around the mountain.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because you have to keep Coquitlam in mind, too.
Yes.
Which is a very important residential place for the university. And the North Shore, because the Second Narrows Bridge was, in the earlier days anyway, quite easy to cross.
Used to be.
So it got a lot of people, faculty living across there, but it also attracted students from the North Shore. And Capilano College was only beginning. Capilano College was only.
No, fifth year.
Yeah, good job.
Three.
We're doing an interview here.
Order
of
the branch, right?
Yeah, these are customers. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
So where were we? Housing and transportation and access for students were connected. I was on an aircraft once coming back from a meeting in Toronto and sat next to a woman whose name I don't think I ever learned, but she claimed to have been on an early planning board to do with the university. So I don't know what that means or who it might have been. But what she said was that the location of the university in part had, in some kind of formal or certainly well understood sense, taken into account the fact that residential availability, housing for a new faculty who would not be very high on the pay scale yet because they would be young, was going to take place in Burnaby and in North Vancouver and in Coquitlam, these three locations. And they'd worked that part of the geography out in some kind of well-understood sense at the time of the establishment of the place.
I guess my question, though, the housing is definitely a problem for SFU and the commuting campus. But I'm wondering, though, when we look at SFU as a part of Burnaby Mountain, what are we talking about in the way of history? I guess it's part of the problem that I've faced in this project, the history of Burnaby Mountain, is that SFU seems so separate that by default I end up looking at the environmental history of Burnaby Mountain, and SFU is a piece of the mountain that has been separated from that history. So how can we integrate SFU back into the history of Burnaby Mountain? What would we be talking about?
I don't know that you can. I don't know that that's how you would think of it, Al, but they are certainly separate.